Ray Middleton, reel 3.
What was the date of your arrival at Tobruk?
I believe the 1st of April, but we must have arrived in the last few days of March. I had my 24th birthday during that flu episode in Matru, so that was the 10th of March, so we must have arrived somewhere about the 15th or something of March, in fact, but we were just dumped in a patch of desert and told, make yourself a shelter, with absolutely nothing to do it with. I tried using stones and we just had a dust storm blowing and it wasn't very helpful. So people started scrounging sheets of scrap iron and whatever. And at that point, we weren't near the Italian-built concrete sangars, which were at least something if you could get underground and escape, all but the fleas. And the fleas would find you anyway. But there was nothing much. It was just a patch of desert with dust blowing over it.
So you weren't very close to the town itself?
Oh, no. We were asked to anticipate. We didn't know it, but the instruction had come. Rommel's forces had reached Adjadabia and were threatening our front line. Therefore, in case of contingencies, use the 2 battalions you have to garrison the dangerous part. So they spread 2,000 men over 32,000 yards of frontage using the Italian-built sangars that you saw in that map.
There were different lines of defence, as I understand.
At that point, there was only one major one. The Italians hadn't apparently made a separate line. They'd used only one, an average of 8 miles from the port. And they'd been thinking of being able to defend it against attacks from the Senussi, the original inhabitants from whom they had captured it and stolen it, but it was usually used. And so they weren't thinking of defending against a major European power. And that's one of the reasons why it was possible to be taken by the 6th Division. It was set up with a World War I thinking. And 8 miles is not adequate for a barrier, especially when you've got just a small anti-tank ditch. They did have that. Concrete in some areas, just dug in others. And that itself was a major undertaking. And then concrete pits to live in or fight in. But concrete pits have the inevitable Maginot Line approach. People tend to get in there and stay in there rather than get up and fight. You're much better off where you can't get down too deep, so you've got to get up and fight. And yet, I think the Maginot Line thinking probably affected the Italians, who were all conscripts. A few officers may not have been. And they certainly weren't that keen on fighting a war.
So what was the strategic importance of Tobruk at the time?
It was a very good port in a long, sandy coastline, a little bit like having a Fremantle harbour already developed along Western Australia, much the same. Otherwise, you had a shallow, sandy spot with very little opportunity to unload troops or stores without, because there were simply very few on the North African coast.
Did you actually get to see the town of Tobruk before attacks took place?
No. Saw nothing of it. We were driven straight to our spot out in the desert, and we were merely told that there is the harbour at Tobruk is about 8 miles over there, and there it's full of sunken ships left from the first battles. But you'll be supplied, and we've got to deny it to any enemy because it's important.
So what equipment did you have? You've mentioned a little bit, but
we had our own rifles and bayonets and what we could scrounge from Italians. We had a small supply of a 303 ammunition. We were lucky. We found that Italian Regia Aeronautica ammunition fitted 303. Theirs was actually .305, I think, but it was their aircraft ammunition was within a thousandth or whatever of an inch of our own, and it was interchangeable with Brens and rifles. So I personally used it when I got a Bren. I used Italian ammunition for that. We were issued with Mills grenades after we'd been there a couple of weeks. I remember my officer saying, "Have you done a small arms school at Randwick, Corporal Middleton?" And I said, "Of course not. But they were not authorised to insert fuses in grenades. You will watch me do it." So we were at least given Mills hand grenades, and in the meantime a handful of, when I say a handful, I think one per platoon of Bren guns arrived, which is the first that we'd seen other than one reverentially displayed in Palestine. So we were given about 5 minutes instruction on how to clear stoppages or change barrels in a Bren, and then we're told you're Bren gunners. And since I had a Lewis gun certificate, I felt, well, that's all right, there's not much can go wrong with the Bren. They made one mistake quite early on. They issued the Brens from England with a rod, a cleaning rod, which we subsequently found had been withdrawn very quickly after use because it jammed. You used the same cleaning system as with rifle. Instead of using a weight and a rope and a pull through, you're using the steel rod with cloth in it to clean the barrel. And what happened is that almost inevitably it jammed in the barrel. So I remember very early on I removed the bullet from the actual projectile from a bullet and put that in and then fired the Bren over into no man's land. And I've written and been published a little story about, I wonder what happened to a surprised person when this spear-like object went a couple of miles out into no man's land. Anyway, because I'd removed the bullet, it didn't blow up the gun or anything, and I got rid of that cleaning rod. But we had Brens. In the meantime, we were still making do with the Italian anti-tanks guns. I was given a one-hour instruction, along with a lot of others, on a 47mm Breeder. They were a good gun with a range of 200 metres. That was the only limitation. And we were given, a Royal Artillery man said, well, I think you'd use a team of three, and he suggested how you might work it. And one do loading, one do aiming, one do firing. He said, since you've got no sights, it would fire very high muscle velocity. Keep it straight on the target and don't fire till you were within a couple of hundred metres. So with that instruction, go back and be an instructor. So anyway, when I got back, there wasn't one anyway. But a few days later came the first attack, the 10th of April, a probing attack by their first German, I suppose you'd call it advance guard. And when they found they were stopped, largely by 75mm, then they withdrew. Next day they made a much more serious attack. In the meantime, the Royal Horse Artillery had brought up a battery, and that plus our guns repelled it, and they lost a few their vehicles, armoured vehicles, and Rommel was misled into thinking that it was much more strong defence force. And in his papers he apparently stated later that we were stopped by a considerable force, so we withdrew to group.
What was your initial understanding of an impending battle?
Well, they said, there's some Jerry's coming, stop them. I think that's the way the order came.
What was your experience of the first battle?
Well, I was not on that line, because we were scattered over so far, we were covering, well, 16,000 yards is a long distance. I think about 13 kilometres each battalion had. So one of our companies, one of our forward rifle companies, was on that Durna Road, which was the coming from the west, where the Germans first approached. And we waited till they were close before we blew the anti-tank cover. There was a bridge over the anti-tank ditch left by the Italians, and they blew that and then fired on the Jerrys, which of course meant a bit of an obstacle for them anyway. They were reconnoitring, and the next day they tried to make the attack. And I have an idea that their technique was to rush forward, try and fill in a section of the ditch and cross over, which is the way in which the Australians had attacked in January anyway, as a logical thing. But in order to do that, you've got to send a party close, do a quick filling in on quite a wide ditch, 10 feet by 10 feet type of thing, and try and get vehicles over the top or people climbing. And in some of those early battles, with the rifle companies, I was with headquarter company, remember, the rifle companies were getting pounded a bit, but of course they were able to inflict pretty heavy casualties when you've got some Brens. And we did have a Vickers gun company attached to us, and Vickers were very effective. And then when you've got targets of that sort, we were using some of the Italians, but not many of the Italian guns at that point, other than their artillery.
Did you have any air support at all?
Oh, none at all. There were three planes, and they were called Faith, Hope and Charity, nicknamed, still on the flying from the small airstrip near the harbour. I don't remember ever seeing them. I think they were, much as talked about them, I have no memory of seeing any of them. Probably never got out as far as the perimeter.
What sort of planes were they?
They would have been Hurricanes, or more likely biplanes, I think, from the World War One vintage. And they were able to match the Italian biplanes. As long as the Italians were at a similar level, well, we could cope. Probably, I think they would have been gladiators. They used gladiators not only aboard the aircraft carriers, because they're very good for short takeoff, but they were all we had until a few better planes arrived. And they were keeping the better planes to the defence of the UK at that point.
What was the general feeling amongst the troops after the defence of, or the initial defence of Tobruk?
We can stop the buggers. And the Germans made the mistake of sending in, a couple of hundred Italians to make a frontal attack across the lines of the tank ditch, and the casualties in their line were very heavy. They weren't terribly either enthusiastic or good, and they were easy targets. They didn't like fighting at night. We liked fighting at night. We patrolled at night, they didn't. So they were the ones who shivered in their beds when we patrolled at night. And although I didn't have do a lot of it personally, I know that it became a regular pattern. Do night patrols, make sure no man's land is ours. And there was wide no man's land, because it was pretty open desert, and you tended then to have the lines far apart.
So what orders came in after the initial attacks? What were you told you had to do?
Well, we were told move down to the southeast section, because they said the two brigades had broken back through our lines and were in with us, so we now had enough force to stop the Italians and Germans. I think they put the emphasis on Italians, although that was numbers. The Germans, of course, were the fighting force. And we were moved then to what was called a quiet sector while we were given further equipment. Not that there was much to give us, but we got a little more. And there was a long area, a wide area rather, which was not occupied because it was simply too blank to have anyone other than trying to, if you don't want to dig through shallow rock. So the colonel was given orders, you will not have the headquarters in the front line. So to his disgust, he was forced to move back and start forming what General Morse had prescribed as the second line, the blue line. He then made the original perimeter as the red line and designated one couple of kilometres back, I couldn't give the exact distance, it varied a little, as the blue line, as the rear defence in case of a breakthrough. And headquarters were set up there, and that's where I was then placed along with the rest of, or most of my own group. And our job was then to still patrol and be ready to back up as required. I know we were moved to the front line a few days later when we had an expected tank attack. So I remember getting orders, right, you will go along to the perimeter to where there is a gun waiting. You've been given a 47mm breeder instruction. I said, yes, right. You go and help pick it up. So when we got there, about 2 or 3 k along inward post, I found a 47mm breeder with half a trail behind it. No sights, of course. And a few boxes of ammunition. So we spent about 4 hours carting that gun back and its ammunition, and then we set it up and said, without a trail, what we'll do. So what will we do? We found that one of the groups had set up a series of sandbags. We said, right, we pinched those and we used those to back the trail in and set it up. We're told there'd be a tank attack likely in the morning. I asked about ammunition. I said, it's all there, plenty of it. I said, is it primed? Oh yes, it's all primed. So we sat up and waited hours and hours. I conscripted one of my mates and a chap who was headquarters clerk to be my two offsiders, and waited for dawn, and fortunately no tanks came. When it became light, I looked and I found that the ammunition still had the aluminium insert instead of the fuse. They hadn't provided any fuses, so I was rather relieved in that case. And of course I called my officer a few rude names for telling me that it was all set up.
When did you realise that you were in a state of siege?
By the 11th of April we were told that we were cut off within 24 hours. The Germans had to go around, we'd stopped him, but they were going to move on. Our job was to act as a blocker until our forces could muster and come back. In the meantime, then, hold the fort. Churchill expects you to hold, it's a vital port for the Allies, da-da-da-da-da. The Navy will see you are right. And I think they talked about the Air Force, but we took that with a grain of salt. We saw nothing but German planes.
Were you regularly bombed in your position?
No, not regularly. Our biggest problem was that after bombing the harbour, which was their main target, planes then came in very low. They went out at 50 or 100 feet because the 3.7 anti-aircraft guns couldn't depress that low. So the Germans used to go out there and at whatever point was convenient for them, and they had airstrips in the desert about 10 miles out beyond. Some of them had been left behind, no doubt, from the Italians, others they made. And I can remember on one occasion, I think we were just eating a mess of bully beef, when the alarm went. The alarm consisted of a battery that went beep when pressed. And so we sprinted to our guns. I'd been given a Bren gun mounted on a upright stand and told I was ACAC with one assistant, and I was inside a few sandbags. And then I saw a batch of half a dozen planes coming straight out towards us over the top. So I did the fastest 100 yards I've ever done, dived in and found that I couldn't depress on the stand the Bren enough, so I unhooked it, put it on the sandbag and just managed to get it cocked and fired one burst at him and he fired one burst at me. And I found bullets on either side of me. He was too close, fortunately, for me. But I did get a few hits on the plane, and boy, for what that was worth. And immediately afterwards, the adjutant bellowed out, "Corporal Middleton, how many shots did you get off?" "One burst, sir." "Why didn't you get off more?" was the only question. I said, "Because I wasn't time, sir." And I looked around to find where my assistant was supposed to have been. He was left manning it while I had got my Dixie of stew. And I found he was in the middle of shaving, and he had flung himself down full length on the far side where he was a much greater target. Instead of having manning the gun, he was hiding in the corner. So, of course, I was rather rude to him.
What sort of camaraderie developed between you and the other men?
Well, I wasn't a close mates. This particular fellow was inclined to drink too much, and he was one who always borrowed from me in Palestine and thereafter, always borrowing 10 bob till next payday. And on payday he'd pay me back, and the following day he'd borrow it again. That type of item. And I think I had a degree of respect in that I was able to hold my own as a soldier. I don't think I had a lot of liking. There's a difference. They regarded me as a city twerp, probably.
It's been said that warfare is generally 95% boredom and 5% action. Was this a case in Tobruk for you?
Very much, yes. We were told that on the Blue Line we must be on standby in case of an attack. So they said, right, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. And in no time, working 24 hours a day on four-hour shifts, you find that you can't sleep for more than 2 hours out of four, and you tended to be unable to wake up when you did get to sleep. So it was quite a problem. One incident that occurred, we were patrolling a line of about six posts on the Blue Line, and a picket at night then, I and three others were in one little sanger together with instructions to patrol, and on that they had a series post. One was a 75 mil gun manned by a group from transport with no trucks, and another was a machine gun, Vickers, I think, and so on along these posts. And our job was to go from one to the other to see they were alert during the evening. And we were supposed to be doing relieving each other in two-hour shifts. And then one night early on, the mist came up, which it did do in that time of the year, and these posts were irregular over a patch of desert with nothing much to distinguish it. And I couldn't find the next post, and I walked on, I walked on, I walked on. And I knew I eventually got lost, but I had to find a way. The next thing I saw something looming up, and I found it was the remains of an Italian truck that had been wrecked and had bullet holes through where the driver had sat. So I sat in there and heard an air raid in front of me, which I knew through the mist must be the port of Tobruk. I thought, well, I'd better wait here till dawn anyway and go back. And at dawn I went back the way I'd came, where I could see what I was doing, and found my section. I found I'd crossed the minefield twice there and back, and I'd gone right through the lines of the Northumberland Fusiliers, who were supposed to be trigger-happy machine gunners, and they hadn't woken up, and I hadn't seen them, and and shook my relief and said, "Hey," and, "Oh, am I on duty?" I said, "No, I knew you were tired, I let you sleep." So that was the end of that one.
How did you occupy yourselves when you weren't actually preparing for combat?
You tried to write letters if you could, or you tried to talk a bit. There was no other entertainment. Absolutely no music, no books. Or one of my group, no, not at that point, we didn't have anybody with a book of any sort. So there was nothing to occupy except the once a day we'd have the news came out and the so-called Dinkum Oil, the journal published daily from headquarters, that came only a couple of copies to the battalion, they're pretty precious, and they were supposed to be passed around and read to us, and it gave somewhat propagandist view of what was going on in the war. It was picked up from the BBC, and Lord Haw-Haw quoted considerably. Lord Haw-Haw, of course, claimed that we were the self-contained prisoners. You are caught like rats in the trap. You are the rats of Tobruk. And that, of course, became our theme. Yeah, we made it a title of honour to be the rats of Tobruk who would not be caught, and self-sustaining prisoners and so on. And that, of course, set our backs up and helped maintain morale.
One of the orders, I understand, was that it was to be an offensive defence.
That's right. So that was why Morshead originally and our own battalion commander strongly believed in patrolling to make sure that the people in the other side of the line were more at fear than we were. So we did extensive patrolling. Largely this was the rifle companies went out. They used Bren carriers once in a while, but they were inclined to be noisy and could be detected. And they also kicked up a lot of dust if you took a vehicle out. So they, after a couple of attempts, they stopped using carriers out in no man's land, and they used foot patrols. They would go out, usually with an objective, using compasses and so on, trying to count out paces to where we believed there might be enemy activity. And then they would establish listening posts, and if they'd hear picks on the ground, then they would usually find a party of Italians working and blast hell out of them, capture a prisoner if that was requested, and take it back. And that, of course, was keeping the enemy on its toes, keeping them well back and scared stiff.
What sort of equipment would they take on patrol? I mean, I understand they would wear different clothing.
No, not much. We didn't have different clothing, other than the fact that those who could, you would use boots that were quieter, but we didn't have any in that part. Later on, I think, the long-range desert group, they developed soft shoes and so on. We didn't have any such gear. We merely had army equipment, and you had to move quietly as you could. And we were improvising. I remember, for example, we were told, booby trap all of that wire in front of you to see that no enemy can infiltrate. So we collected up a batch of 100 of these red devils, the Italian grenades, and we tied them with wool or wire onto the barbed wire, and then as we moved away we carefully pulled out the safety pin, which meant that on movement they were operated by shock. Once you'd removed this cover, then you left it so that any shock would drive a pin onto the detonator. And the result was that little jerboas, one of the few desert items, the little hopping rats of the desert, got blown up quite a bit. And sometimes they went off because the wind rattled the wire, and that was enough to pull the string. And we had to, of course, know our entries through the wire to be able to get in and out and patrolled. It didn't pay to go in the wrong spot.
So what were the conditions where you were posted?
Well, we were close to where there was a cookhouse with a cook terribly nervous because he was using the burners, which was a mixture of used fuel oil and water dripping and burning, so it made a terrible noise, and therefore he couldn't hear alarms for planes. And the cooks tend to get bomb happy pretty quickly. And on one occasion, when the time I think when I shot through and to grab my Bren gun, the cook was the last person to get into the shell hole. All the people who come for their Dixies tossed the Dixies away, sprinted and were in the slit trench, and poor old cook was on top, which didn't help his morale much at all. The same applied with their doctor, who was a bit of a screwball. He was known as Aspro, and that was his total remedy for anything. And he had his great, or sanger, I suppose, built about 8 feet across on high on drums, and a great red cross built on the top, which served as a marvellous target for the Germans coming out. So he was bomb happy himself in no time, and he was sent back and put in charge of a
caught a little bit unawares there. He was put in charge where?
Of a bomb happy ward at Alexandria.